I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian and writer Dane Baptiste, a modest comedian and writer, and my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello.
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. We're talking everything from existentialism to philosophy to stories about the galaxy to conspiracy to rap to rock to polka, whatever you want to know about, we will ask the questions. On today's show, our guest is a comedian, a great comedian, who is the winner of Best Newcomer at the Black Entertainment Comedy Awards, the Leicester Square New Act of the Year, and joint winner of the Amuse Moose Laugh of Competition, or the People's Champion, as he was referred to. He has also appeared on a number of different TV shows, panel shows, and stand-up shows, and even has his own new show pilot based in Nigeria, his ancestral home. Good friend of mine and longtime brethren, it is Fumbi Omotayo.
Wow, yeah. Man. Thank you. That was a special intro. I was like, I did all of that.
You've done it all, mate.
Done it all on reflection.
Well, otherwise, your website's lying. Yes. Is all I can tell you.
I was like, I'm going to borrow a lot of those credits.
Take them, man. Talk them up. It's actually special because I also have an additional podcast, Quotes Full, which I do with Fumbi. Yes. So in a way, this is kind of like, I feel like, in a way, I'm like Method Man. And it's like an appearance by like the Jizza or the Rizza or whichever you're preferred.
And I'm appearing on your little solo project. You know, when you bring in like...
Yeah, I have to bring in the
Raekwon or one of them and them to come. Yeah,
is that like who that you're one. Saying
Let's
you
do
are?
That. I'm
you want to be Ghostface?
I'm Ghost, man. Ghostface.
I'll take Ray. Tony Shark. Ray's a cool name, which I guess makes Howard the Hizzer, of course.
Fine, the Hizzer, yes.
And makes Kay from Quotes Full, the Kizzer, who was the first guest. First guest on Dane Baptiste Questions.
Okay.
First one that came through. He lives in Brixton, isn't it? So
he had to show up to
him. He was down the road, wasn't he?
So he was down the road, but also he was very valued. Big up to Kay in the house.
To Kay.
And big up to Fumbert Inadi Bloodclot, as he is also known.
Yeah, man. Fumbert Inadi Bloodclot.
Sober Kays. How are you, Fumbi? How is your psychological and spiritual welfare?
Wow.
Now, you know why? Because
you can sum that up really quickly.
Yeah. How are you as a person?
I mean, you know what? I'm evolving. Feeling? I feel like I'm evolving, man.
Evolving? Yeah. Good, man. Growth is always good.
I'm trying to evolve in this crazy world that changes daily.
Yeah.
You know?
It's good, man. Evolution, man. Key to survival. It's good. I'm jumping on this trend because we also had the pleasure of having Reggie Yates on the podcast. And he said, how you doing? And I was like, and you always feel this need to like qualify yourself and be like, I'm working on this and this and this.
Yeah.
And this. But he was just like, how are you doing as a person? So I want the trend to continue whereby we feed into the emotional intelligence of other men.
People don't take those things like for value anymore. When you ask someone, how you doing, you know, we just kind of follow your Instagram posts and your Twitters and your
and
Facebook,
presume
and we so create this narrative around
or
you.
Ask how you doing, and even if you wanted to give a curt answer, it'd be like, not so fucking well, Dane. No, you shut up. At least you had the catharsis of saying so, you know? I think it's important.
I think if you followed me on social media, all you'd really see is my cat, which would, you know, not really paint. I don't know what picture that really paints.
I mean, if you've got a cat in your life, you're always going to be have a beta status anyway. So
I give a shout out to her, but she's a cat, so she would have no reference to this. But
I mean, irrespective of if she was aware of it, she would have no concept of gratitude because she's a cat.
Yeah.
Assuming she's a she, right?
Yeah, she's a she. Yeah, Prim, she's very good.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm obsessed by cats, as Dane knows. They like the most, talking about work, because that's what you're saying, is when you ask someone how they are, often they'll just say, oh yeah, and I'm doing loads of stuff with my life that's really good.
Yeah.
Whereas a cat, it doesn't give a fuck about you. It's focused on its game. It's got a very specific job.
Guided by instincts. Catitude.
I love cats, man.
Catitude is honestly one of the people I respect most in the world is my cat, because the focus she gives to her hunting, which is her job, and sleeping.
Yeah.
Incredible focus.
That's it.
I love cats,
like a lion. You know, you hunt and you rest. I have a theory regarding catitude, as you know, where I was watching something recently where they were doing it was archaeological kind of dig or whatever, but they found like mummified remains of like young kids who had died from like appendicitis and abscess, and they also had been mummifying cats.
Right.
And obviously cats were kind of deified in like Egyptian culture. And I feel, and even there's a goddess called Sakhmet who has the head of a cat.
Right.
And I feel like cats are aware of this. I feel like somewhere in their DNA,
yeah.
they are aware that at some point they were datified or they were held in high regard in society.
And they're still trying to hold on to that. Yeah, life.
They've never forgotten it. Yeah. They've not forgotten it.
Whereas dogs know they're dickheads.
Yeah.
Well, dogs, yeah. I think dogs are aware that they have a domesticated role.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think dogs have been easy to domesticate. I mean, because dogs are, they come, I guess they're bred from wolves, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas cats, I guess they've probably held on to a lot more of their features.
We have fucked up dogs, by the way. I don't know if you...
Massively.
We have really... We say the man's best friend, but we have fucked them up.
Are they from the same as the wolf clan? You know, like the hunting dogs?
They're
from that, like...
I don't know how the taxonomy works exactly, but the family they're from is from canine, which would be wolves.
Right.
And then more things like dingoes and like coyotes and stuff. And lower down that chain, you'd have dogs being domesticated. And the funny thing is, though, that... Obviously, dogs have a number of different breeds,
yes,
but they're all from the same species.
Mm.
But it's a very cultural thing where we pedigree breed them, which is actually inhumane or incanine. Is that the word I'm looking for?
Isn't it?
It's eugenics. Yeah,
it's literally eugenics.
It is eugenics. It's because it's not evolutionary. Because a lot of time,
no,
some dogs, like the British Bulldog, for example, just to as a very symbolic of the fact that it's been bred on the basis of its aesthetic features.
Yeah.
So much so inbred that bulldogs cannot conceive without the help of a vet. That's how I'm bred there.
Wow,
that's a bit bleak. So imagine if that was you.
What does that mean? If human beings are bred, and you know, obviously we have a lot of systems whereby we do emphasize homogenous aspects of our, in terms of race or eugenics, as you mentioned. If we were to go that far and continue to breed just to focus on particular features, then you know we'd be fucked up. And that's
the
thing.
That's where it's going, though. Right?
I mean, if anyone who adheres to the idea of complete racial purity, that is going to be the ultimate, is that you're going to have to start sexing some cousins up.
Yeesh.
Yeah, and it's not going to work out well for you.
Yeah, that's the end of the podcast.
That's our message. Love everybody or fuck your sister. That's our message.
Turning dogs into fucking, well, just look at the state of a pug.
Anyway. Yeah, a pug's another one. Like they have a lot of issues with their breathing.
Why aren't they a cute looking? They're weird. Because they look so weird.
But lots of dogs
they become
are
cute. You know?
Yeah, lots of dogs are cute. Pugs are cute. And Pomeranians are cute. And Chihuahuas are cute.
But in a lot of pain.
And pugs live a good life. Like, you don't see pugs on the side of the road looking for, like, dustbin cans.
That's true. Or French bulldogs. Yeah, or French bulldogs.
They live that good life.
French bulldogs live pretty well. Whereas bulldogs, that's a road dog.
You know, the road dogs get no love, you know. And they look good. I look okay, you know, but I fall on hard times.
I don't know if the same applies to humans, but maybe that's a dark road to take us down.
It might be, you know.
I mean, you know, some people argue that certain members of certain monarchies or dynasties have a lot of lizard-like features. and it could be the point, yeah. But then, I mean, it's a whole other podcast in terms of like, there have been incidences amongst elites where due to inbreeding and very selective breeding, some people have had birth defects and they are quietly sent to asylums.
Nice. Quietly, you know.
Yeah.
Wow.
In a book called Bedlam that was recommended to me, I started reading.
Right. Nighttime reading, bedtime reading. Yeah.
Oh, definitely not bedtime reading. I'm trying to get some sleep, Howard. But yeah, it's a very interesting book in terms of how we used to treat the mentally ill, which is why I say, "How are you from being? How are you feeling as a human being?"
So you're learning these things.
Yeah.
This is good. This is why reading is good.
Yeah. One thing I'm not a very religious person, but one thing I heard in a sermon was, a life shared is a life spared.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a religious person, and I can honestly say I don't think I've heard that quote. I'm more familiar with, if you give, you will receive.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
But yeah, so with no further ado, which I'm not sure is the right use of that phrase, just give you an idea of how the show works for me. We invite our esteemed guests to ask any question that is burning at the front of their mind or deeply seated. Which we discuss, and then Heza would ask us a question, which we'll also discuss, and finally, I will ask a question that I always wanted to hear you answer, but not had the time.
Wow.
Which I'm looking forward to, and trying to add that ominous tone to it. So
Fumbi.
Sounds deep.
So Fumbi,
I get to set the ball rolling, right?
Yeah, yeah. And there's no wrong questions, no stupid questions.
Okay, yeah. So Will Smith did stand up for the first time the other night, and he said he's addicted. There's a big discussion now. Should Will Smith be doing stand-up? Is it right for Will Smith to do his stand-up? So I wanted to know, you know, what's your feeling about that? Because Ginny actually did a video about it, which was quite funny, telling her, you know, you're a movie star and I do this for real, you know? And so is he doing it because he's Will, or does he have this general passion to try and do stand-up? Or is it because of the attraction of the whole Netflix deals?
course, it's a good question. And I think surprising to hear that he never did it before, right?
Because an episode of Fresh Prince when he gives it a go.
Right.
Yeah. So what happens?
That's a documentary, right?
No, no, no. Because it had guest starred D.L. Hughley.
Yeah.
Right. It was one of the original Kings of Comedy who was a stand up. Right. And there's almost like.
And that was the narrative.
Yeah, that was the narrative. And the narrative was a part. And the whole part of the script was the fact that Will was like, I'm funny. This isn't hard. I can do this. And he was like, D.L. Hughley was like, it's not as easy as it looks. And then Will ends up being, someone sees him doing a very funny act out and offers him like a 5-minute bit.
Yeah.
And he goes on stage and he bombs spectacularly.
Right,
fucking hell. And he also says he's going to quit school and go into stand up. And he says he's been very lucrative.
Mm.
You can understand Uncle Phil's reaction and his mother's reaction.
Oh, Uncle Phil, I bet he threw Jazz out of the house, didn't he?
Jazz got thrown out. He told his mother as well. And then, it didn't go well for him.
Yeah.
And so he had to learn two lessons. A, to respect his friend's livelihood.
But that's all we know about Will Smith in stand-up until recently.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And that's all we know.
But he's never had to, right?
Though. Not really. Because
he's a fairly funny guy, no? Like
massively
he's got
funny
charisma
guy.
And everything, yeah. But, you know, when you're earning 20 million in a film, who has time to go to the Firkin to try a new 20? Who has time for that?
Yeah.
I've got to get my Type 5 for my Edinburgh run. No, you don't need that.
Yeah, on paper, there's a lot that suggests that Will Smith could be a very funny stand-up in that number one. Like I said, he is a very funny comedic actor. An actor with a lot of range. He's done Method when he played Muhammad Ali. But he was a rapper before he was an actor.
Yeah.
So obviously punchlines. And one of his early songs was I Think I Can Beat Mike Tyson, which is kind of comedically based. And
Girls in the World Ain't Nothing But Trouble.
Yeah, parents don't understand. Yeah, so he's always taken quite a comedic slant so far as all of his art. So it's not too far a cry, man. I just think obviously you do a gig and it goes well. I can see you being addicted.
Yes.
Like when you first do it and it goes well, everyone's like, oh, I can't wait to go do this again.
Yeah.
Like you don't decide whether or not you do comedy. Yeah. You don't decide whether or not you can do comedy based on having that set and people laugh. It's when you bomb.
Yes.
Can you get back on
and
the horse?
That's the thing with Will Smith is he can't be a great comic because he's not going to be able to bomb. Because he comes in as Will Smith, his first 10 minutes of an applause break.
What's his first line? What's his first joke?
His first joke is good evening. Oh my God. He said good evening. Huh? And people are just loving it. Do you know what I mean?
He could probably do in a 5-minute set. Basically start with in West Philadelphia, born and raised.
And then drop
three,
the mic on them.
And 3-minute grace, he'll get 3 minutes.
And then drop the mic on them after that.
Yeah.
Because remember, the thing is, the only people that will come don't want to see Will Smith do stand-up are Will Smith fans.
Yeah.
So you have fans already. Yeah, you know what I mean, so how do you win a room over?
He's got some jokes, no? He's got to have a punchline or two.
He
does have to have jokes, but I mean, we all have to have jokes. I guess that's where we get one of the big parts of the criteria, but it's just, there's never really going to, I don't think there'll be a fair gauge or an objective gauge on how well he does.
Yeah.
I mean, the only people, I guess it'd be like a Chortle or somebody like that. and even then it wouldn't be objective.
And they'll be like, they're hating on Will Smith.
Yeah, they'd be hating anyway. So.
You know, so.
But
he's an interesting character to talk about it with, because he's someone, you know, who, if you look at him as a human, as like, even just a storyteller, right?
Yeah,
I bet you, as a storyteller, if you said an hour, in fact, here's a good example. If you said Sly Stallone had taken up stand-up, right?
Yeah.
You'd be like, mate, come on. This is a bit late in the day, right? But go and watch him at the Palladium. Have you ever seen those recordings of Sly at the Palladium? Just talking about his life.
Yeah.
And it's someone interviewing him. And basically, they're 5-minute stand-up stories.
Yeah.
He obviously isn't punching them beat for beat like stand-up.
Yeah.
But they're really, really funny.
Yeah.
So you imagine if Will Smith did that.
Yeah, but I'll go and see that.
Yeah.
Like, I'll definitely see
that. But that's the thing. Yeah. That's what I mean. It's a case of he's Will Smith, so he's already had, all he has to do is be himself.
Yeah.
As a stand-up comedian, you're not going in as Will Smith. You're going in as who is he?
Well, the unexpected is so much. You guys have experienced that. I remember seeing you a long time ago from the John Bishop show, right?
Right.
I remember that was Hackney Empire.
Yeah.
And nobody saw you come in that night.
No.
You killed it that night, didn't you? I'm sure.
It was a good night.
Yeah.
But
Hackney Empire, though, light work for Fumbi. trying to call us. It's like going cost cutter for Fumbi.
That was a home court advantage,
bro. That's what it is. Just goes home, smashes, and then like...
But that's the thrill of stand-up, when no one knows you.
You could see the audience. I was there with my mother.
Right.
She was like a 70-year-old Jewish woman who was like... loving it.
Right.
And I was like, she didn't see you coming.
With Will Smith, and that's the thing. With Will Smith, he already has that, regardless of even him coming out.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to. The only way he can actually gauge himself is if he comes out under an alias and then tries to do a 10-minute set about just whatever he writes jokes about.
The thing is, though, like I said, because how long, I haven't seen the whole clip, but how long did he, I saw him do a freestyle recently, but how long did he do on stage?
I do not know. All I saw was him saying, yeah. He didn't really put the clip up, he just said he opened for Dave Chappelle.
Because, I mean, yeah.
He opened for Chappelle.
And that's what I mean.
Like, that's another thing. You're opening.
That's just a perfect storm of black excellence. You know what I mean? That's not fair.
I don't
that's
know like, any comedian
that's not fair either,
whose first gig was Chappelle.
Where was your first gig? Let's find out. Where was your first?
Mine was at Coldjaws Comedy Funhouse.
Right.
In the basement in Corks. That was my first gig.
So it was mine.
We came through the ranks, bro.
Opening for Chappelle, right?
Hell nah, we opened for Chappelle.
Did yours go well for me?
You know what? Mine went really
You showed it. You showed it. No, so did mine. Really, no. My first show went very well, man.
It was really...
Second show went well.
Yeah.
And then I made the mistake of being like, what, third time's a charm? I'm funny, aren't I? I've proved that now. Got down to Brunel Uni in Zone 6 and it did not go well at all.
But the thing, you know...
So badly.
The thing of when it goes wrong, and it's a really interesting scenario, because when it goes wrong, it's ultimately... You can do it with the same jokes that got a laugh the night before, right?
Yeah.
And something has gone wrong. The chemistry, it's like an experiment, right? Something has gone wrong and it's out of your hands. And in these people's eyes, you're not funny. Right?
Yeah.
So if you could put Will Smith in that scenario, let's get him, you know, put some prosthetics on.
Right, right.
And then let's see if he can do
let's
it.
See, yeah, because like, then it'll be
like
different.
Why don't we get like a bunch of people who audition for like Fresh Prince and like Wild Wild West and Independence Day. Yep. And fill a room with them, and then we'll see Will Smith. And Will Smith go entertain them.
Let's see what you got.
Basically, yeah. I guess I didn't even thought about it, but I realized for you to be a great stand-up comic, the stakes have to, there has to be an element of risk in what you're doing. Mm. And when you're Will Smith, there's no risk because you can say, but he's Will Smith.
Yeah.
It's like Chris Rock. He's not great in movies. But then we say, yeah, but he's a stand-up. That's where he excels. So we give him a pass for the movies.
Yeah.
But in stand-up, he has nowhere to go because that's meant to be your game. Mm. Another thing I found interesting was that Will Smith tries out stand-up, you know, opens for Chappelle and says, yeah, I'm hooked.
That's not trying out
but
stand-up.
But here's the thing, though. Eddie Murphy, we've been begging him to come back for years. He's like, nah, I'm good. Because he knows I'm going to be judged by a higher standard.
And if you've signed a over $100 million studio deal,
yeah,
it's going to be hard for us to relate to your observations. See, that's the main thing about Will Smith as well. It's not even just... Because like Fumbi correctly says... You don't get into stand-up by opening for Dave Chappelle. That most people, when you get into stand-up, you open it. If you're opening for Dave Chappelle with the name of a bar in Kingston.
That could have been taken so many ways.
Two for one.
Yeah.
Two for one at the Dave Chappelle, student night. Then that's what you'll be doing.
You flies on the door.
You're not going to open with arguably like one of the top three comedians on the planet. No one's doing that. But and also, like I said, I think Will Smith, while he has a wealth of life experience he could speak about, I think he may struggle with relatability. Mm. I feel like it's like, you know, people are like, oh, you know, he's like, my wife is so duff sometimes. Oh. Like, your wife is Jada Pinkett. Shut up.
You know,
shut up, buddy.
You know, they do those, you know, those applause break moments where you say things that people are going to clap on. So I had dinner with Mandela. Oh my God.
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
My name's Will Smith. I'm the other presidential candidate.
Obama.
Yeah. Maybe that's why he's doing it.
Yeah, ooh,
he's gonna run for president.
See,
with Kanye, he's vice president.
Oh my God. The day that happens is the day America shuts down.
Well, I don't know, they're pretty close already.
They're on the way,
They're on the way already.
Can you imagine Will Smith and that sounds like an album release, not a presidential
campaign.
I wouldn't
even buy that album, to be fair. I don't know if I could buy that album.
They're gonna spit lyrics for
the whole. I think if maybe Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince.
Went
for president and vice president. I'd probably check that out.
If Will Smith becomes president, Philly's coming up.
Dane can vote as well, don't forget.
I can vote technically.
Yeah,
I would vote for Will Smith for president. Actually, well, depending on who he's running against.
Well, Trump, obviously.
Well, then I'd definitely vote for Will Smith.
I had a joke when Obama was.
Maybe governor of California, I think he should go for. Definitely.
Yes. Yes.
Definitely go for governor of California.
I do think that there's something to be said. I'm going to be slightly in favor of Will Smith doing this on one sense, which is he obviously thinks he's got jokes to tell. Otherwise, that is one thing. So let's just take another example or something, right? So if Will Smith got caught the other night, an open mic night, playing guitar because he'd written this ballad about sometimes it's hard to be a movie star or whatever song he's written, he'd be like, oh, look, Will's writing a song and singing it. Like, you'd be like, that's a bit... Okay, well, I guess he wants to sing that song, right? But there's something about stand-up, I think, that makes it more like, oh, what the fuck? There's not enough laughs to go around anyway without you taking some of them.
Yeah, I think
my angle is not the fact that if he wants to do stand-up, it's great. Like, he can do what he wants. He's Will Smith. But when the debate comes on how good he is, it's not like you can never gauge it.
You can't, you can't separate Will Smith from there, exactly.
And the thing is, the truth is, Will Smith's doing stand-up now because he's bored. Okay, he's gone from movie star to Instagram to now doing stand-up. He doesn't know what to do. That's really what he's trying to do. He's just trying to engage people.
So is he not? I heard he's a Scientologist, and that's why
I heard maybe he got fired.
Online. If he got fired, that's a great thing. I'd hear about that. I think. Yeah. I guess the way, even over the last, even very recently, maybe the last 2 years, even stand up in terms of how it's delivered and in terms of the format has changed significantly.
So much.
Obviously, the rise of like Hasan Minhaj's show, which wasn't just strictly stand up, and Neil Brennan had three mics, and then you had Nanette as well.
Well, I always remember Richard Gadd going to see Richard Gadd in 2015, which I don't know if anyone ever saw that show or any of our listeners.
I'm aware of some of the show, yeah, but if anyone hadn't seen it.
This is a man on a treadmill for an hour talking to a video screen.
Wow.
And that's like, it was genius, like genuinely one of the most amazing shows I've ever seen, but it ain't the same as stand up. And that's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
Like, it just ain't
stand-up. I mean, what's wrong with it is that it's referred to as stand up.
Well, this is, but it's comedy and it is funny, but it's so difficult to compare to straight stand-up.
It's theatre. You know,
it's lads camera action.
Yeah, exactly. But theatre has a dichotomy, can be comedy or tragedy. So I like Richard, and I know he's an amazing playwright. I wouldn't necessarily call his show comedy, which he didn't either, because he said he entered it in the comedy by accident. So I think if Will Smith was to do like a kind of retrospective or have a format where it's not really him just having the classic premise set up and punchline, but maybe spoke about his experiences and kind of cut into songs or act out or the like, then I'd be like, yeah, I'd definitely check that out. So there's probably a way for Will Smith to do stand up, but I think
I just don't want it to be jokes. I don't want it to be a thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like big Hollywood movie star not doing movies right now. Stand up, you know? Yeah. Then you had the list of all the A-list celebrities who used to be regular and popular.
I get it.
Trying to do stand up now all of a sudden.
I get it. But then if you were asked to, someone asked you to rap for Will Smith.
If someone told me to open for Will Smith, I'd be the first one on the team. That's why I don't mind the sound. I don't mind him doing his thing.
There's actually a comedian called Will Smith.
Oh, we have comics.
There's actually two comics called William Smith
and another guy called Will. Remember Will?
Yeah,
Willis.
Remember Will,
yeah.
We know a guy called
Will Smith. There's another comedian called Richard Pryor. So imagine how it is for those guys. You're always going to be in somebody's shadow.
And if Will does, you know, Will and My Friends, you know, that kind of tour,
that's going to slam.
That will sell out everywhere.
First of all, what he needs to do is just introduce Alfonso Ribeiro to open for him.
He did stand up as well.
He did actually do stand up.
It was trash.
I'm sure he.
It was terrible.
Oh, was it really bad?
He tried to be edgy by calling on Viv a bitch, because you know they have beef with her. Alfonso. That was as edgy as he got, and now he was like bitch, and I was like, yeah, whatever, man, just tap dance and go,
just do the Tom Jones.
Keep it pushing, bro. Like, he had no material.
He had no material. That's another thing. If
you want me to get him on the podcast,
I would love to have him on the podcast. But if Will Smith was able to perform in front of Janet Hubert Witten, who played the original Aunt Viv,
wow,
then we know if he was really good.
She walks away like, you know what?
She was like, all right. He has some good lines in there.
It's a new Dane Baptiste TV show called Tough Crowd, where we get comedians to play their toughest possible crowd.
That's right.
You can get that teacher from school who told you you were...
Miss Taylor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
But you played to her before, haven't you, I think?
No, not Miss Taylor. I haven't played to Miss Taylor yet.
Oh, right.
Well, Miss Taylor,
Oh, Miss Taylor, it was like the last day of school. And I went to next door to my... Because me and my sister are twins, but we were in separate classes. So I went to her class. So I think I was mounting something on sugar paper, which you should do back in the day to make your, before computers were ubiquitous. Anyway, I was trying to make it look nice for my last thing, just wrapping up all my work. And I think I was talking to one of my friends, and she was under the impression I just came in and just started randomly talking. She's like, "What are you doing here? Oh, here he comes again. You know something, Dane? You think you're so funny, don't you? You're not that funny, and you're not going to go very far in life. How about that?" And I just remember thinking to myself, like, I'm 11. This is... I just remember thinking, I'm 11. Like,
what school did you go to?
I went to regular.
I mean, we had to worry about gang violence and, you know, getting into fights, but nothing that serious.
No. I just remember
your teacher took it to the next level.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. I was just thinking, if you care this much, like, I'm not even in your class. I just thought we're not even in the same class. Like, I spend so little time around you. The fact that I have such an emotional drain on you says more about your ability to do your job than me. I knew that at 11.
Yeah.
Because there's those teachers I hated. I hated teachers. I had a lot of teachers that I hated. But the last day of school, I don't care.
Yeah, fucking
I'm never going to see you again. It does not matter. Like,
what did she do next? Last day of school forever. Okay, yeah. And our last day of school.
Primary school. So I'm like, I'm leaving. It does not matter. And like, if you are confident that I have no potential academically, then I'm leaving now. I'm out of your hands. You can just watch me crash and burn. Imagine how she feels now when she said, you're not even funny. And now I am really funny and getting paid to be funny.
Yeah, what's the name?
Miss Taylor.
Miss Taylor, you're well wrong. You were well wrong.
But even Miss Taylor, to be fair, I knew you were wrong then. And in your defense, we both know I didn't respect you.
She was the
as
world's
professional.
Worst fortune teller.
Yeah, she was. She dressed like one as well. And the funny thing is, she dressed like one
as well.
She dressed like one as well, funnily enough. Yeah, she had a real weird kind of goth thing and all this whole different colored hair thing, an alternative, which I realize now is because a lot of teachers are themselves frustrated creatives that take a job where they have a lot of free time.
You know, teachers, shout out to all the teachers, but they make the worst audiences, man.
Really?
Yeah, the worst. Oh my God. They're the worst.
I did a show in in Leicester. It's all teachers. And I'm doing a set. I said, you're talking during my set. She goes, I'm on a night out. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, teachers are the worst. They can't handle not being the authoritarian in the room.
Right.
And having
and they're checking your grammar all the time
and
as well.
And adhering to the rules which they enforce themselves. Right. So again, like in terms of Miss Taylor, I'm still like, I just think,
yeah.
I hope you're well, Miss Taylor. I mean, we both know you're not, but I hope you're doing all right.
Well, we wish Miss Taylor and Will Smith all the luck in the world.
All the best.
No, I'm not wishing. Will Smith has all the luck he wants. But Will Smith, I hope when you are looking to do a combined showcase, Fumbi and I are available.
Yeah. Fully available.
What night that would be?
I'll clear my diary for that.
Up the creek. Come to Up the Creek.
I think Will Smith and
Will Smith, man, that would be dope. Come down to Up the Creek. We'll take you seriously then.
By the way, you can't do Fresh Prince because another comedian already did that show in the UK. But that's for you to deal with. That's another story for another time.
Another shot. Take a shot.
That's real talk. That's not a shot, Fumbi.
That was a good question. That was a seriously good question.
Thank you. Thank you.
Were you worried? I got a sense that you were worried your question wasn't good, but that was a very
that
good
wasn't
one.
My question initially, but I changed it the way.
Did you go much deeper? Was it much darker?
Oh, no, I went much lighter. I saved the deeper one for when Dame invites me back.
There will be a sequel.
Mm. I guess it's my turn then.
It's your turn, Howard.
All right, I'm going to ask two stand-up comedians and obviously writers and genius men.
I don't know why you're leaving yourself out of stand-up comedian, Howard, but
well,
fine.
You know. But I've been thinking about this thing recently because I've changed job, right? I've moved company and I've been thinking about how the people I used to work with, I used to make them laugh without even thinking about it. Like I just, you know, I used to have like a buzzer on my desk and when someone would say something particular, I'd press the buzzer and they'd go, and then everyone would laugh and it would be like, oh, and I so stupid, my sense of humor at work, I'd take my weekly shop in, my list, you know, like the receipt, and I'd read it out to everyone on Monday morning and then they'd have to guess how much it cost me.
Right.
So my question to you is this, because now I'm at a new place, they don't know me. I don't know if they're going to laugh at me at any point in the future. And doesn't it make you think, and you must think this every night, isn't actual physical laughter just the weirdest thing?
I think it's probably the most instinctive thing we have. Like, it's probably one of the only, I guess, vocal expressions being that, what does it say, 90% of most human communication is nonverbal.
Mm.
I think it's one of the only ways we can communicate emotion that transcends language and gender and age.
Mm.
So it's a very weird thing.
Stand-ups, it's a currency, right? It's pretty much a currency. And so you go up. And did you do a gig this weekend?
I did.
Yeah.
I did two. I was with Dane this weekend.
Oh, really? Where were you guys?
99 Club.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so you get up there, right? And within about, I guess, about 30 seconds or you know how much is coming, is in the room, right? Sometimes, because you see compares sometimes and the room is just being like wrung out.
Yeah,
when it's not going well, it's just being wrung out of laughter and you have to get up there. And how obvious is it to you when there's actual laughter there or not?
Oh, you can tell. Like I've done some gigs where it's equivalent. If I was a naked flame, the compere is turning on the gas. He is not helping. I've definitely done that before, and I think that's one of the big differences between comedy and other genres of live performance or dramatic or performance is that. Yeah, you can find out within 30 seconds if you're going to have a good time or a bad time. And like I said, the currency, it's one, you can definitely see how it's going to pay off initially.
Mm.
And then it's just how much you want to invest in certain types of laugh. If that makes sense.
I mean, sometimes it's really weird because sometimes you feel like it's going to be a good one and you can actually lose it at some point.
Right.
Kind of tail off yourself. Because? Sometimes you think, it could be... anything, man. It could just
someone
be
sends you the wrong direction, a punter.
Yeah, sometimes you could have broken from the set. You could have just something could have happened, or you're just a bit tired yourself.
Mm.
Maybe you came out swinging too much, and then you start talking about, you know, I don't know, you talk about race and then everyone's like, oh, then they freeze up.
Well, actually, I told the story about my teacher on stage once at a gig called Sunday Show. Good friend of mine, Anthony Williams used to run. You know the one that used to be in, I think, I want to say Lightroom, like on Shoreditch High Street?
It was in Camden, wasn't it?
No.
Is it Anthony Watson?
No, Williams, Anthony's gig. Kay used to be there a lot.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
So I remember doing this gig, doing that story, and some of the room enjoyed it, and some of the room, I got nothing from them. Tanked. And then this girl came playing acoustic guitar, and her dad even came on stage and was like, that guy, basically insulting me, being like, that guy probably has a problem with teachers because a teacher can be your parents, your pastor, and he has a blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, first of all, it's obviously a joke. And all of these people are sitting here acting like they've never had problems with teachers. It really goes against the entire narrative of the people that are at the show.
Mm.
And finally, if you was any kind of father with any kind of balls, you would have said to me what you wanted to say when I was on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So you're raising your family in a house of cowards. So how about that? But the point is that, yeah, you can definitely kind of gauge if it's going to go well or badly. And yeah, some jokes, same joke delivered the same way, may tank in another room.
It makes it fascinating, right? Because like, take watching a movie, right? The average movie, I'm trying to think. I rewatched Deadpool recently. I enjoy
part one or two.
Part one.
One, yes.
Yeah. Part very, very much a fan of any film
it's
of that
kind.
It's
the highest grossing R-rated film of history.
Really? That's Deadpool. Good fact. And I mean, I just watched that and was just like, I didn't smile throughout. I didn't laugh once, but I was just enjoying.
Yeah.
When you watch a movie, you just sit there and enjoy it. Whereas when comedy, if you don't laugh, then you're like, well, what the fuck am I doing? What am I doing? But I think we, people in the industry, and anyone who looks at it in a kind of professional sense, whether they're critics or whatever, cerebralize.
Completely.
It's so much that when you, because this is why partly I was asking this, is because you went to this pilot in, was it in Nigeria?
It was here.
Oh, it was here, but it was with a Nigerian Nigeria, audience.
Yeah, it's going to be shown to Nigerian in Nigeria.
Yeah. And was it a Nigerian audience predominantly? Or?
It was a diaspora audience. So that's like kids who were born here, but they have like Nigerian or they have Nigerian parents.
Ancestrally, I'm also Nigerian. Yeah. I wasn't able to make it. But
he's like,
I just wondered if that, like comparatively, how that felt in front of that audience who are maybe not intellectualizing it or not over analyzing it in the way that sometimes you go and see certain.
No, that's the thing though. The audience don't really care about the 2 plus 2s and the, you know what I mean? When you're talking to the average person about.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The greatest comics. You tell a person Bill Hicks is better than, I don't know, Michael McIntyre. To the person who loves Michael McIntyre, they ain't trying to hear that because he makes them laugh.
Mm.
Whereas someone who loves Bill Hicks is looking at the way he's able to talk about social commentary and also make it funny, but he's not the belly laugh comedian.
Mm.
So it's all down to, so your audience really don't see anything other than he's making me laugh.
Yeah.
And so it's only us who, the comedians who are like, I need to have this kind of punchline or my message has to be hidden here and stuff like that. To the average person, it's just, is he funny or not?
Which I think is a good thing for that we have that as well, because, yeah, it's like I said, if you look at something and you look at the execution of a script or dialogue and how it works in a particular scene, and that's because you're probably more industrially and personally invested in the artistry of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like with comedy, I think people, for the most part, the paradigm of it is that we are the comics, they're the audience, so we make them laugh and they laugh. And that's the job done. And there's, but then, like I said, there's many ways of make. This is why going back to even the first question with Will Smith, there's big differences between performing comedy and making people laugh. Because you can fall over, you can have a pratfall, you can do slapstick, you can slip comedically, and that's funny. And you could argue your job is done based on the fact that I did something, I did something proactively making people laugh. But really, so far as comedy, for us, it's, you know, the execution of a concept. Is it original? Does that come from that person? Is that a valid observation? Have they arrived at that way that, you know, the audience wants to see it coming? So for us, there's just a lot more to it, I guess. And
do you still laugh at other comedians?
I laugh at other comedians. Yeah, definitely.
When you're on a mixed bill.
Yeah, I feel like I've lost some of it though, because of the fact that you do start studying and thinking, oh, how do they get there, and where was their thought process behind it? But yeah, I do still laugh at other comedians.
What I do is, when I'm on a bill with someone, it's hard to laugh because you're not really paying attention because you're trying to figure out, trying to focus on your stuff.
Yeah.
But if I go to a comedy night, it's really refreshing because I get to laugh. I get to enjoy, especially when it's comics I don't know. Right. When you know comedians, it's hard to laugh because you know them so much. But I like to watch comedians I don't know, and I'm like, I'm pleasantly surprised. So yeah, you still laugh over comics. Don't get me wrong, your thing's right. You judge a lot.
you definitely judge a lot because, and that's because, like, it's because I suppose you're so well versed. In the same way that, like, if a footballer's watching other footballers, then, you know, I guess audience fans are looking at score lines and points, whereas other footballers might be looking at, you know, your touch and your vision, and they can probably scrutinize it with, because they're with a lot more of a learned eye.
I like watching open micers.
Really?
Yeah, because I value their guts. Because when you've done stand up for a long time, you put so much emphasis on trying to be funny and trying to match the persona you've created.
Mm.
Whereas open micers, they have no persona, and their jokes, sometimes you're like, wow.
That's what you thought was going to work. It's also good because they don't respect you and don't give a shit.
Nope.
And sometimes for me, I like going to these nights where, you know, there's less experienced comics just to prove you can still do it at their level. Because a lot of the time, I guess when you start doing comedy and you have that ego, there's a real impetuousness where it's like, well, I'm funny too. Why is this guy funny? That guy on TV, I don't think he's that funny. I'm not funny. So people tend to approach with the ego, again, not really knowing about the journey and what's required in order for you to hone your act. So I like to see that sometimes, because you see, it's the way of keeping your finger on the pulse. You're aware of what trends are occurring where comedy is concerned, and, you know, what people are talking about. And I like it, because it's like, you're just kind of making it a challenge for yourself. Otherwise, it's too easy. Because come back to what you're saying with Hawaii, your new job, you don't know if people find you funny.
Well, it's just a weird thing, isn't it?
It's because you're not used to the room.
Same way,
like there's rooms. If you go and perform in a room often enough, then you kind of get alert. You learn the acoustics of that room. You know, you learn the kind of, like, I guess, average demographic of that room, and, you know, their income is. So you know what kind of jokes kind of work. So you become more comfortable. You become in a room, just like you play in any stadium. You know that, you know how the grass works. You know how fast the ball works if you're playing at home. Whereas when you're in an away game, you don't necessarily know the temperature of the pitch, if they spray that pitch down. So there's a lot more to take into account in terms of how people maneuver it. And it's the same thing with a new job, is that your old job, people have a context for who you are.
Yeah.
They're into your staff. They know all of Howard's nuances and idiosyncrasies. So it's like,
when I talk Howard. A lot of shit.
Yeah, but they know, but they still know it's you. It's still Howard's shit. You're still Howard's shit. And it's funny because the way it translates on stage is that sometimes people kind of start to have that kind of environment that nurtures their need to do comedy. And they're like, oh, I got this mate. My mate's so crazy. And they'll talk about it, not knowing that audience, like, well, we don't know your mate and we don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
we don't know. We don't have a context for what, we don't have a context for your journey that's kind of, you know, precipitated in you having this relationship. So if they make a certain comment in context of who they are, you know why that's funny. But when you relate it to an audience who don't know them, and we're like, well, why is that funny?
That is true, because when you walk into a comedy club, especially when it's one that I don't know, it's like outside London, the first thing I do is look around the room and start looking about, okay, where's the mic? You know, where's the mic stand? But there's rooms in London, like up the Creek, for instance. I did the Creek 2 weeks ago. Creek's where I won my first competition. So doing stand-up there, it's like coming home.
Right.
You know, I know exactly the fire I'm going to bring. I know how it works. I remember when they did a renovation in the room.
Yeah.
In the whole comedy club. I walked in, I was like, oh my God, now I have to learn again.
Yeah, it took a while.
I had to bring this fire back. Yeah, because they changed the entire room.
So we're saying that what laughter actually is the environment you're in.
All of it, as much as anything. It's a reaction. So the ambience and the feng shui, because then you learn the acoustics and how, because once you learn a room, you know how to project to different parts of the room and what parts people find it harder to hear, or who's more likely to hide from your gaze, and you work all that stuff out. But the thing is as well, like, that's my advice to comedians, is that, like, I wouldn't even try and get too comfortable in rooms. I mean, you'll learn that over time with experience as it is, but it's the same reason why you don't bring friends to, because you'll never get, again, you're not going to get like
a genuine response.
Yeah, genuine response, because people, they kind of know who you are and stuff as well. But like, taking into account all those things, you know, based on like, you know, rooms and stuff like that, and like, when we said you start looking at the room and where the audience are, you can already, again, start to gauge if it's going to go well or not, or how hard you're going to have to project based on just had the height of the ceiling and had the layout of the chairs. And, you know, it's like, for example, if chairs are put around the table and the table's circular, well, people are more inclined to talk to one another if their backs are to the audience, they're all sitting around each other.
Yeah.
So it's a lot harder for them to pay attention. Or, you know, if your stage is too close to the toilet, then how disruptive is that going to be if people have to walk across the stage? Or how loud is that hand dryer going to be when I'm on stage? And
All those things that you
start to get a wider perspective of how your craft works.
Yeah. It kind of makes you know what kind of comedian you are as well.
Mm.
For instance, everybody assumes you want to do like a concert tour where you're doing a stadium or an arena. I don't want to do arenas because I'm not an arena comic.
Mm.
I like the intimate feel of comedy because I tell, I bring you into a story, into my own little world. And I don't think I can capture that in an arena. I feel like my comedy would suffer because of that.
Right.
So therefore, I would stay away from an arena. Even though it's the more profitable thing, I'd rather do like a Hackney Empire across a month or something like that, because it would fit my style of comedy and can get much more from it. Because everybody thinks being a comedian is just going on a stage and making people laugh. There's so many elements of that night that can help you get to the best part, to get the best of you.
Mm.
And it's really important to know what kind of comedian you are. So then you just don't get into those traps.
Yeah. And the thing is as well, like I said, like going back to what you saying, when people know who you are, so you laugh at everything you do.
Yeah.
But I think as you go on and you get a certain level of experience, you are able to accept that, you know, depending on what kind of style you have, some people aren't meant to laugh at the stuff you're saying, because essentially a lot of observational jokes are going to be at somebody's expense.
Mm.
So when I was performing in Dubai, for example, and a girl came out and she was like, oh, it's great. What are you guys doing now? Oh, by the way, that woman really didn't like your material. And, you know, the woman's lips are full of collagen implants, like sugar daddy, you know, and I'm not writing it for you to like it. And some of the stuff I say is about you.
Yeah.
So you should be pissed off. So it's sometimes I'm happy to lose people in the crowd because, you know.
Oh, my God. When I learned that, when I got to that place where I didn't care how people felt,
right?
I just became a real comedian.
Wow.
Because it was, I was tired. Yeah. You get so tired of trying to please everyone in the room.
Because you know the joke's funny, right?
Yeah. And I know my intentions behind it. Well, and
yeah,
I know another thing.
More, the latter, you know your I know
my intentions behind it. And another thing is, you have to look at, you play the numbers in any comedy room. There's a room full of 100 people. How many people do you really think you need to laugh to get a reaction tonight? 30. Mm. So the remaining 70 people there, whether you laugh or not, is really irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because even when you leave a comedy club of 100 people, you think the 100 are going to be like, let me get your number. More time you get like 2 or 3 people really coming up to you saying, I really enjoyed that.
And even if they did, they may forget you.
They may forget you as soon as
on the next bill, you might smash it, but they'd be like, what was that guy's name?
Yeah, what's that guy's name? Yeah.
You. So it's
So the idea that you have to make everyone laugh and everyone's feeling you, it's really not true, because only your core people actually tend to follow on. Exactly. And most people come for the night, for the hype, you know, so.
And a mob are fickle, Howard. So if some people at work don't like you, fuck.
Well, I mean, it's just interesting. Here's the real thing in my head about it all was just the fact that your daily life has been filled with the laughter because you know that audience is going to know your...
You've been spoiled, Howard, man.
Yeah, I've 3 years.
You're in your comfort zone. You're in your comfort zone.
Three years.
Big man on campus.
Yeah, now I've got to go fucking, I've got to start again. Exactly, like, fucking hell.
You were the prom king back then.
I was talking about my cat at the fucking office today and they were looking at me and I was like, like, oh, you don't know. This cat's funny. Like,
it's like
you've
been
playing
for Real Madrid for like 3 seasons and now you're like
captain of
Burnley.
Angel de Maria. Oh, yeah, Angel de Maria, because we went to
Manchester United. Yeah, and it's
the tech is not good enough.
6 months, had to go to Paris.
Tech ain't good enough.
Well, I'll report back to let you know if people are laughing at things that I say in the office.
But you know what? If they don't laugh, you have to go back into your writing game.
Yeah, okay.
Or remind them who the boss is.
Well, not me. Yeah,
but you know him.
Yeah. I've met him.
You're sending such a harsh email. Yeah. That'll teach him.
No, I'm sure it'll be fine. It'll be
you
fine.
You know, the first times where you bomb, which we will, just take them as, I'm just learning the craft again.
Yeah, good. Yeah, okay. Starting from scratch. Cool.
Don't put no pressure on yourself, man.
I've started something about my lunch today. I reckon I can work that into a regular bit.
Progress. That was not perfection.
Get on. But that was my question. What is laughter and how do you keep it? That's the thing. It's hard, isn't it? You fucking got to start again. Hard,
You know the sad thing about laughter? Like you said, how do you keep it? The more we do as comedians, we let go of the laughter.
Mm.
I was watching a set of mine the other day. I said, Mike, I don't even do those jokes no more. And those are good jokes.
Why didn't you bring them back?
I missed them. I'm trying to word them back in a different situation. But I was like, that's some good shit. Yeah. But I'm like, I've left that. I'm onto this now, you know? Mm. So that's the sad part about laughter. You know, you have to let them go.
Yeah. Well, it's time for the third and final question.
It's it's a good point about leaving things, letting it go, and then sometimes bringing it back. Listeners may not know, but I know Fumbi very well.
Yes.
Fumbi is a big fan of 90s hip hop. as am I. Mm. And normally it would be a point of contention because we are.
There's something brewing here, by the way, listeners. There's an argument coming.
Well, not an argument. Could be just a debate. But
luckily, I stay strapped.
Yeah, you stay strapped all the time. Another person that stays strapped was Tupac Amaru Shakur.
That's right. Machiavelli the Don.
Was he passed away? Was it 90? Was
96? 96.
96.
Yes,
97 was big.
Yes. Six months later.
Who I prefer, but that's another story for another time. Now, that's not the point. The question is, as I'm sure you are aware, there are several theories with regards to the continued existence of Pac, who is referred to as Jesus of the hip hop culture, which I think is
Elvis.
Yeah, well, Elvis. Well, Elvis is another one who said to come back, but I mean that's another story for another time.
Yeah, Elvis. Yep.
But my question is, Tupac's back, right?
Okay.
And the first thing he wants to do is get in the studio.
Uh huh.
And he needs someone to exec produce the album. That's you, Fumbi. He wants 10 features. I don't know. Okay, that's maybe. Let's say he wants 5 features on this album.
Oh.
Dead or alive.
Dead or alive. Oh, yeah. Thank God for that.
Who do you pick to be on your executively produced Tupac album?
God. Oh, my goodness.
This is the best hypothetical we've had on this show. That is.
All right, because you said dead or alive, yeah? I'll tell you the producer. I'm going to bring on.
All right.
Okay, not just the feature, because you need the right producer, right?
Hey, you're the exec. It's your choice, bro.
Your money. Right. It's my money.
You've got to take the decisions.
As a side note, what's your label called?
Oh, my God. What's my... Foomstar Records.
Foomstar Records.
Copyright.
Just so you Foomstar your, Records is Foomstar a registered Records. Trademark of...
Yeah, man. Office is based in Hackney. Guys, get me.
Nice.
The producer I'm bringing back, because... he was so instrumental in Tupac's music. It was Johnny J. Johnny J basically was Tupac's producer. I feel like every rapper had a guy who knew how to get their sound out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Notable tracks by Johnny.
He did Wonder of Heaven's Got a Ghetto.
Nice.
He did a lot of Tupac's early music, and some of these like classic songs were done by Johnny J. So I'd bring Johnny J back to produce the album because I feel like...
How did Johnny J die?
He died in prison. And it was a man. It was actually really weird. He was climbing up a prison wall and fell. And then he died. Yeah. I mean. So, yeah.
Stranger deaths in prison. So. rest in peace to Johnny J.
So I'd bring back Johnny J because I feel like Tupac worked well when he was directing, making his music.
Mm-hmm.
And the features, wow, 5.
Yeah, 5.
Oh my goodness. Okay, I'm putting
because you know you're going to be a shitload of stuff getting submitted in there.
Yes. I'm putting Biggie on. I'm putting Biggie on because Tupac and Biggie did a song called Running. The original version was produced by Easy Mo B, which is fire.
Yeah.
And it's one of the hardcore tracks I've ever seen. And it was like Pac and Biggie at their youngest, just hungry.
Yeah.
You know, just spitting fire. So I'll bring Biggie on, even though they had that little East Coast, West Coast.
Running Part 2?
Running Part 2, yeah. You know, we're coming back or whatever they call
come
it.
Back.
You know,
reunion.
Reunion, yeah, you know.
Reconciliation.
Make up to break up type stuff.
Yeah, I feel you.
So I reckon that would be fire.
Kind of like the equivalent of Still. So it would be like Still B.I.G. like with Dr. Dre. And
yes.
Which is, you know.
When they quench the rumors
but
and that.
This is the thing, the irony of the whole.
Faith will sing the hook.
Yeah, exactly. Faith could sing the hook.
Faith could sing the hook.
That's nice.
That'd be tight. Like that. You know what I mean?
Because the irony of it being like, especially where. Because Tupac was born on the East Coast.
Yes, he was born in Baltimore.
Yeah. And then Biggie used to rap West Coast style.
Right.
And then even with Still Dre, like, that was written by Jay-Z.
I know, right?
So it's like...
It's just the talent, though. The talent is there, man. And thing is, when Tupac first heard Biggie, he went bananas because he was like, this guy is a dope MC.
How could you not?
You know, because Biggie was fire. I'll put Nas on the album as a feature. Nice. Simply because Tupac and Nas had that conscious flow.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Tupac was a bit more militant. Nas had the suave, the smooth, poetic.
More jazz influence.
More softer approach of giving it to you. Whereas Tupac was straight in your face.
Nice.
But I think the blend will be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's 2, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'd have, oh my days, you're killing me with this one, you know. I'm going to put, this is going to sound weird to everyone, but again, you have to understand I'm a Tupac fan. I'm bringing Big Syke back. Big Syke was part of Thug Life.
Right.
Also one of the Outlaws. But he was one of Tupac's closest road dogs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they just made good tracks together.
Nice.
Now, I wouldn't buy a Big Syke album on its own.
Mm.
It's a whole different ballgame with that
one. That's like, you know, Annoyed in Mobb Deep song Burn?
Yeah.
When he says, hey, you don't think I live a pop life now? Because, hey, you could get pop right now. That verse he does on that.
Yeah.
That was enough to get him a record deal.
Right.
But would I buy another Big Noid record? Probably
right,
not.
But that verse
was fire.
It's like Method Man. Like, with Wu-Tang, Method Man is fire. But as a solo artist, you're like,
one. You didn't like Tikal?
Okay, you just made the track. That's one track. I mean, it's the album.
Yeah.
You never left to say that Method Man album.
The one he did with Redman, that one album.
Blackout was a great album. But then part two was...
Yeah.
Like, you're too old to be a boy band.
That first album deserves proper recognition.
The thing is, what happened was after, I think, Rockwiler, who was one of the producers, had the motorcycle accident afterwards.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Crazy, wow, that's sad, man.
No, man.
DMX.
Oh,
will
Tupac.
Be with Tupac.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Now, that would be a Thug Life song.
I'm glad you brought that up because we need to address the issue of the Tupac clones.
Yes.
Because
right. Shout out to Ja Rule.
Yes, Ja Rule, among many.
Lil Zane.
Because what people understand is that, like, for people that, because especially now in the state of hip hop, where a lot of people will talk down about, you know, their predecessors like Biggie and Tupac, not realizing that whole East Coast, West Coast beef and the media attention that it brought helped to bring hip hop to its current level of prominence, and as a result of which, like I said, the Tupac status was like, you know, he's the Jesus of hip hop, and so much so to the point where that Thug Immortal and that Thug Life aesthetic that Tupac had has been one that people have tried to replicate to this day. But you look at like a lot of the successors, like I said, DMX was one with the whole the muscles and the tattoos and the blood affiliation.
Yep, bandanas.
Then you got like the bandanas, and you got Lil Wayne as well. Lil Zane, another one.
Ja Rule.
Ja Rule, another Tupac clone.
Yep.
Pretty much, if you see a rapper without their top on, with body, with tattoos,
and chains, it's a Tupac clone,
because,
you know,
especially because like 50 Cent, like you're from New York, it's not warm enough for you to always be, not have a top on. So again, it's just always, and the whole thing has always been, everyone wants to look like Pac and kind of rap like Biggie.
Mm.
Because of being hardcore, but having radio-friendly songs.
Yes.
With the hardcore lyrics in between and having like a good R&B hook, which was kind of like the blueprint by Bad Boy and
Biggie.
But it's just, I think for the most part, anyone who's like, because really, other than if you served in the armed forces, like body art was not really that big amongst like African Americans.
Yeah.
And Tupac kind of popularized that whole ideal. You know, that's the reason why you see people tattooing like ISIS on themselves to this day.
It's nuts.
Or even stomach tattoos.
Yeah. It was
definitely just part of his legacy.
Like the NBA, I feel like you can't even join a team now without a tattoo.
The NBA, you
credit that to Allen Iverson.
Yeah.
Yes.
True. Allen Iverson kind of allowed that to migrate into.
But that was with hip hop culture and NBA.
But I loved it when
kind of merged, right?
Yeah, but I loved how those players were coming into the game in like fur coats and baggy jeans, and the owners were like, oh, hell no.
Exactly.
This ain't the annual pimp convention.
Exactly.
It's the NBA.
Exactly. And it would be a big fur coat because you imagine about.
They came
to
look like pips.
To put on a 6 foot seven.
They
had
gold chains. You had those little rich white kids in the suburbs saying, "Mom, I want to get a gold chain." They're like, no.
They used to say that. Now they'll buy it for them kids.
Right.
So we're up to number, is that three?
That was four, wasn't it?
That was four. DMX was four.
The last one, I'm going to put a female on. Put Lauryn Hill on there.
Oh,
I think Pac and Lauryn Hill will do a nice little.
That's some
like, not even Lady of Rage from Death Row.
You know why? Because I want Lauryn to sing the hook and spit. You know how hard that would be if Tupac and Lauryn Hill she'd do this rap with him and then sing the hook on it.
That's a good point.
A hard song, you know.
So we're kind of halfway through the time for this question.
Yeah.
So that's the first CD. So
but also
CD number two, because we know Tupac does double albums.
But also one thing I've got to ask is what would the world make of him right now?
That's a good question.
That would be a
I think tough... there's two misconceptions of Pac. People think if Tupac was alive now, he'd be this angry character or this, you know,
like an industry,
troublemaker.
Industry bully, yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, the whole East Coast, West Coast thing, that was like a money thing. That was a case of, I think he was hurt because of what was happening. He felt he had friends in the industry and he felt like they betrayed him. So it was smart of him to go at the biggest rapper in the East Coast.
Because
if he could go at Biggie, everyone would think he's untouchable. Which again, no one else in the world could go at
Biggie. Again is a blueprint which is followed very much to this day.
Which was out of war because he was reading about, you know, the article from Niccolo Machiavelli.
Yeah, so. the prince, wasn't it?
Yeah, so he was learning these things. He knew he had to, because remember, his stock was low. He just come out of prison, no one was really, you know, fucking with Pop.
It was the label dropped him as well, right?
Interscope had dropped him.
Yeah, yeah.
So no one was fucking with him. No one wanted to sign him because they said it was too much trouble and he was broke. So he knew if he comes out of jail and he goes at Biggie and survives, they'll think he's immortal.
Yeah.
And that's what pushed out that thing. So now, but the thing is, what he really was just someone who was trying to get the message of the experience of a young black male in America across.
Yeah.
And but he just caught up in all the other stuff as well.
Do you think he could believe what it turned into? Like, think of any.
He said, in his raps, he used to say, you know, when I die, I want to be a living legend. Or he had a song called How Long Will They Mourn Me? Mm. And he would say stuff like, you know, no one in the world loves me. I don't think he realized the impact he had while he was here. Mm. I think if he really did, he would have slowed down his life just a bit.
But interesting. Then, yeah, it's hard to see that. Hard proposition to think that someone would slow down.
At 25.
This is the thing, yeah. I think it's a very, I mean, myself, some. Especially now I'm in my 30s, there's something to reflect on is the fact that, yeah, it's so crazy to imagine that those achievements are at 25.
Yeah.
Because remember, like, as well as, you know, an impressive discography, like, he was an accomplished actor.
Yeah.
You know, who, you know, it appeared both in...
And wrote books.
He was in a film with Tim Roth.
Yes.
That was the last film,
Gridlocked.
That wasn't a bad film.
Oh, it was in a film with Tim Belushi.
Was in that as well.
She was in that, yeah. Mm.
And then he was in Poetic Justice with Janet Jackson as well.
He was in Gang Related with Jim Belushi.
Above the Rim. And he was supposed to be in Menace to Society. But
he was. Did a film with Mookie Rook called Bullet. So he was very talented.
And there was another film as well. Above the Rim.
Above the Rim. And then Juice, which was a cult classic.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That film is crazy, man.
Yeah.
Right, if I'm going to exec this record, I want to cause as much trouble as possible, right? So instantly I'm putting Kanye in there because I just want to see what will happen.
Oh, that would be a dope song, though.
We just want to see what would happen, right? Yeah. How would that, I mean, yeah, look, you know, when Kanye's gone, we'll think back and go, yeah, he was an egomaniac, but we'll remember how talented he was. Mm-hmm. And I think
we'll see. It depends what happens. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
I recently was at a cafe Nero really late at night in King's Cross, right? And I was listening to this, I heard this track come on. I was like, fucking hell, that's amazing. How rarely do you Shazam? I don't know about you. I Shazamed the other night, dude. Really? Yeah. I'm like midnight and I'm like, fucking hell, this is so good. I couldn't quite place. I'm tired. Mm-hmm. And I put it on. And it was a really lost track from the 8 Mile soundtrack, an Eminem track. Mm-hmm. And I was like, fuck it. Like, Jesus Christ, that guy. Oh, was God. Seriously, he
he's
still
monster.
Is.
Oh, he's a monster.
Seriously good. Imagine that track. Tupac.
Do you know the funny thing? Tupac and Eminem have done a track.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, Tupac was dead, though.
Was that the running one?
It was One Day at a Time.
Oh, I see. They put him on.
Eminem produced that album, so they had it on. But Eminem, because remember, Eminem did a song with Biggie as well.
Yeah.
Dead Wrong, which is basically a hardcore bloodbath track.
It's like a horror film, it's a horror film, they're just going off. You know, you remember there was a time when they rap was moving towards something called horrorcore, and
right,
the Wu-Tang's guy was the Grave Diggers,
right
had a bit, and then like Nas's song I think Back to the Grill was kind of like very horrorcore, and the idea was that the lyrics were getting worse and worse. It was very short-lived, but then we say it was short-lived, but then if you look at a lot of the mumble rappers and kind of SoundCloud rappers today,
like, who is it,
the Raider Clan with the Space Ghost Perp and stuff, they kind of had very kind of very horrorcore sound.
I just think on this album, I just want to cause trouble. I just want it to be like in the press every day that something's going on. So I get like Action Bronson down because like he's just a troublemaker, right? and you know, I like his flow. I think he sounds like he's never prepared a moment in his life for anything he does.
Never.
So I definitely put him in there. I put Ghostface Killer in there, definitely.
Oh, that'd be a sick one.
Yeah.
Good choice, because
he's the one solo artist I can constantly listen to from the Wu-Tang Clan. Yeah. I wouldn't really pick any other solo albums up.
His storytelling ability is incredible.
And it's a good choice because I think Tupac wanted to sign Wu-Tang.
They went to sign DMX. Death Row were going to sign DMX.
Wow.
Yeah, but it fell through.
But like, there's like a love song he wrote, Ghostface, on one album. That's like,
there's one song he did about All That I Want Is You with Mary J. That's one of the hardest ghetto ballads I've ever heard.
That is one of the best. One of the most gifted guys of all time. And then obviously number five for me is Will Smith.
Of course,
Big Will.
No, but to be fair, so far as the top rapper actors, That's a pretty good choice. That's a good choice.
I would say that's not a far shout because Tupac did, you know, do songs with Digital Underground. And if you look at Shock G, had that Will Smith type of style, which was kind of like, you know, funny funk and stuff like that.
He used to dance with them.
Yeah,
right?
He used to dance with them. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's a good bringing. Kind of style.
I like that, man.
Dane, you posed the question.
I did.
Let's hear it.
All right.
I reckon Dane's been. Got like, you know, one of those
because
police things where he's picked all the names.
I need to say before you go why I didn't put Jay on the track.
That's because honorable mention.
Because yes, honorable mention. But because I put Biggie on and you know, I'm not gonna say Jay and Biggie are similar, but Jay and Biggie are similar in terms of their flow, the New York style.
We're talking like Jay-Z, not Jay-Z, Electronica, right?
No, Jay-Z. We're talking Jay-Z.
Now, see,
there's a guy who's got some serious as well.
I'm going to use that one.
Yeah. So go ahead, Dave.
I feel like, you bring a good point because maybe Jay Electronica, the rebirth of Tupac or his resurrection would be enough to bring Jay Electronica out of retirement or absentia or exile or whatever the fuck Jay Electronica is doing at the moment. Can we have an album, please?
Come on the podcast.
I know you listen, Jay.
So
Jay Electronica for both his production and lyrical skills, I think would be a good addition to that album. Kendrick. Because obviously Kendrick probably
from the West.
Yeah, from the West. And
that'd
and,
be a hard tune.
There have been comparisons and obviously the level of influence because his album To Pimp a Butterfly was originally going to be called To Pimp a Caterpillar, which would have abbreviated to Tupac.
Right.
Really?
Yeah, which is why he has the Tupac skit at the end, talking to Tupac. And in his video, High Power, he talks about Tupac's birth and his real name being Lassane Perry Crooks.
Lassane Parrish Crooks.
Parrish Crooks, yeah. So, yeah, probably the only person who loves Tupac more than Fumbi, or as much as would be Kendrick Lamar. So I'd want to have...
Tom Jones.
Awesome. Amy Winehouse, maybe.
Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, nice. Why not?
So
have Amy on there, so that'd be good. And then...
You can hear, you can almost feel that.
And then maybe even Mac Miller.
Oh.
Only because he recently passed away, so I think a Mac and Pac. Mac and Pac would be a good title for a song. Yeah, and then, do a great sitcom. That'd be the video, the concept for the video would be like a sitcom. And
sitcom would get really twisted really quickly.
It would definitely get. Am I on four now? Oh, that's tough.
Yeah, you got one more.
I'd probably go for Vince.
You, pick yourself, Dane. Just go for it.
I'm exec, man. I don't have the ego, man. Yeah. Remember how that whole East Coast, West Coast thing started? Was when producers are all up in the video. So I'd probably go for Vince Staples.
Right.
I think Vince Staples, again, would be a good choice. He's a very unique artist, a West Coast artist who... definitely has a lot of his subject matter is about playing that line of leaving the streets and trying to do something and having that connection with the streets and gangbanging, but also pushing for positivity and self-determination amongst the diaspora. So that's what I'd go
for. Probably put Gigs on there as an honorary mention.
I was going to say, we ain't got UK.
Yeah,
UK.
So I was going to say Skepta.
Right, Gigs. Nice.
I mean, Gigs would be a good one, but Skepta. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Kano.
Or even Kano.
How fuck is Kano now, man? I'm really feeling Kano.
Yeah,
it's from East London, obviously.
So yeah, hold it down. But
East
I think,
London flow.
Yeah, but I think that that'd be a good triple CD that we put together.
That is a great question. We've had Tupac, Will Smith, and just laughter.
Yes,
yeah.
And no Drake, guys. Shame.
Yeah, shame. Happens.
Even though he's had the whole song about "Are You Riding," so they could have done the riding again. Are you riding? And then who's down to ride? Let me see how that. I wonder. Yeah, it's. I mean, yeah, a large part of hip-hop discussions amongst our generation is Tupac-isms about how he would feel about the current state of hip-hop.
I hate when people do that.
Yeah, I know. Oh, we can't really speculate. Even like Immortal Technique would have been a good one as well, man.
But do you know how many rappers you could put on there?
Yeah, I mean, it would be...
There's so many.
There'd be a queue around the block, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much. It would, and that doesn't even include the online submissions from SoundCloud rappers.
From me.
Trying to get the album, yeah.
I'm trying to get a verse in.
I think I had another idea as well, like before we go, is like, so obviously, you know, with Death Row have obviously this catalogue of songs that weren't released.
Right.
And then you have like Motown, which is like another one of the biggest kind of independently started like black labels that kind of, I guess, push the sound to the world. What if we combine the two? Ooh. Do you remember when Gnarls Barkley did a
Danger Mouse did the Grey album?
It was Danger Mouse. Then he formed Gnarls Barkley with that. Remember he did the Grey album?
He did when he took the Beatles, White album by the Beatles and the Black album by Jay-Z.
I mixed them. So I was thinking I'd do the same and I'd call it Death Row Town.
Oh.
All I want to hear is Park and Marvin Gaye.
There you go. Look, unless Dane gets his money, it's not going to happen. Death Row Town, it's my idea. Register trademark. We could probably end on that.
Yeah, no, that's the
ominous death row time. Fumbi, thank you for coming on the
podcast. Thanks for having me, guys.
Before you go, can you plug? Where can we see
at Fumbi? All the socials at Fumbi Amateo, Instagram at Fumbi on Twitter. Check out for the shorts I'm going to be dropping soon.
Nice.
Yeah, we do. But yeah, man, keep supporting live comedy. Yeah.
And also online comedy too now.
Yeah, well, that's I guess that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Keep supporting online. Keep supporting us wherever you
keep
see
keep supporting
us.
Will Smith as well, guys.
Yeah, you know, keep supporting so we can get that tour popping in London. I can open.
This is it.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, Fumbi. Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him at DaneBapTweets. Our guest was Fumbi Amateo. You can follow Fumbi on Twitter at Fumbi. The show was produced by me, Howard Cohen. You can follow me at The Howard Cohen. The show was mixed and music was by Faye Saki. Thanks to Polly and Gelly. Thanks for listening. And remember, question everything.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.